I think the best thing we can do right now is flood the world with gorgeous stories, complicated stories, messy stories that defy expectation and all the neat and tidy ways we want to create good guys and bad guys.
For Iranian-American comedian Zahra Nourbash, it's been a scary week, but will it keep her off the stage? And Stephen Colbert's bandleader John Batiste lets us in on his almost mystical relationship with music.
It doesn't always have to be lyrical to carry a deep, profound meaning. In fact, I think that every beat and every chord and every combination of beats all carry a meaning, and that's what really is the job of the musician.
Plus, why Cristela Alonso walked away from stand-up after the 2016 election. It's the Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. It has been an intense week between the United States and Iran. In a little bit, we'll get the perspective of an Iranian-American comedian whose cultural identity informs her material. But we'll start with the pianist and composer, John Batiste. He's the band leader for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Please welcome John Batiste.
He and Colbert first met in 2014, when Batiste was actually a guest on Stephen's old Comedy Central show, The Colbert Report.
Thank you, Mr. Batiste, for being here.
Uh-huh, yes.
Uh-huh, all right,
yeah.
All right. You are here, right?
I'm right in
there. Are you alive on the planet right now?
I'm sticking in there.
All right, now, New Orleans jazz musician, your work crosses a lot of musical boundaries. You've worked with Prince, Lenny Kravitz, Wynton Marsalis. You're featured in Spike Lee's Red Hook Summer. And the HBO series Tremé was based in part on your family.
Oh, yeah.
Are you the one with the dragons? Is that your family?
Honestly, I wasn't familiar with Stephen or the Colbert Report, and he wasn't familiar with me or my music. And we met, and there was just a spark. There was something deeper. And we aligned on a lot of different things in terms of what he really loved about comedy and how it can really bring people together and how it can speak to something that is tied to our humanity.
If people watch the show, they might hear 10, 12 seconds of a song. But if you're in the house, you're hearing a whole performance of a piece. And you're doing, what, 4 or 5 songs every day for the show?
Yeah, it's about 5 or 6 songs. There's the opening theme and the closing theme, which I composed. And we play those every night. And then there are the bumpers that happen between acts. And we have 2 acts of comedy, one being the monologue, one being a desk comedy piece. And then we have 2 guests typically a night and then maybe a music guest. So between all those acts and also walking on each guest we play, Stephen is really open to giving me the opportunity to just do whatever it is that I want to do. So we'll play all types of music on the show, from video game music to Beethoven to classic jazz to top 40 to Drake. I mean, it ranges.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a special guest joining us tonight here at the Blues Alley Jazz Club. Please enjoy the vocal stylings of former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch.
Our Ukraine policy has been thrown into disarray. I do not understand Mr. Giuliani's motives for attacking me. How could our system fail like this? It's very intimidating.
Wait a minute. President Trump just tweeted at you. Every jazz club Marie Yovanovitch goes to turns bad. What a jerk.
He is.
Whatever we really bring to the show comes from our life experiences. Johnny Carson said this, and he said it to Letterman, who then told it to Stephen, which is, you're going to bring everything you know to a show like this. And you're going to do everything you know. And jazz is something that I do. So it's a way for us to speak to what's happening in the world. And comedy is what Stephen does, and it comes together on the show.
We're talking with musician John Batiste. He's the band leader for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
I grew up playing video games, you know, and gaming was at its peak when I was coming up. And you know, late 90s, early 2000s. You talk about playing Sonic the Hedgehog. Because it was such a big part of my upbringing that it seeped in without me trying. Either they'll know that it's from a game and they'll be thrilled or shocked by how transcendent it is, or the arrangement that I've done kind of opens the door in their mind to listen to it, or they won't even know that it's from a game and they'll listen to it as if it's any other piece of music without having judgment or having a bias.
I want to play the opening track from your 2018 album, Hollywood Africans. This song is called Kenner Boogie. I want to ask you about growing up in Kenner and what it was like for you musically.
Kenner was basic, you know, it was very, very small. And then New Orleans being this city with this epic culture, and I have this family lineage that I come from, and having that kind of as a part of my upbringing as well, it was almost a sense of having these dual realities. You know, the Baptiste family being one of the largest musical families out of New Orleans, and you think about the history of New Orleans and all of the different cultural influences, whether it's you know, the French and the Spanish and the African and the northernmost tip of the Caribbean is kind of what I consider New Orleans to be. I would go back and forth between those two places, and I think that's why I have this kind of what I consider to be a mix of influences in the gumbo of what I call my my sound, or the essence of John Baptiste.
I want to play something to get at that idea of the ingredients that go into your gumbo. I think you're going to recognize the musician behind this song. That's Evidence by Thelonious Monk. I want to ask you about the first time you heard Monk and what he meant to you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, Monk was one of those individual artists where you hear them and you immediately know who it is. And his piano playing even furthered that reality by showing us that an instrument that is not meant to bend could be bent. He stretched space and time and really came up with his own harmonic language and his own understanding of rhythm by blending sounds of the music that came from the church and the music of ragtime and stride piano. He was just a genius of the highest proportion. So I really am influenced by Monk. I heard him when I was, I really heard him. You know, I had heard of him before, but I really heard him when I was 18 and just moved to New York a year before that. And I listened to him almost exclusively for 1 year until the point where my playing kind of changed. It absorbed his approach. And you can kind of hear the shift between my first album when I was 17. And then my second album when I was 19.
It feels like a lot of musicians can address how they're feeling about the world and how people might look at the world through lyrics. How can you do that when you're just doing instrumental music?
I think all music carries a spirit that is deeper than the words. Even if it's lyric-based music, sound has essence, and the essence of sound has a deeper meaning than what we sometimes can realize, or sometimes realize. We do realize it actually on an instinctual level. We feel it. Like when you hear trap music, or you hear the drums, or when you hear a samba, that carries lineage with it, you know, or when you hear the sound of brushes on cymbals, the sound of John Coltrane and the way that he plays the sax, or the way that, you know, Nina Simone plays the piano. It doesn't always have to be lyrical to carry a deep, profound meaning. In fact, I think that every beat and every chord and every combination of beats and chords and melodies and different timbres all carry a meaning. And that's what really is the job of the musician.
John Batiste is the band leader for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. John, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. When we heard the news that the conceptual art pioneer John Baldessari had died, I felt we had to call up my former LA Times colleague, the art critic, Christopher Knight. Hey, Christopher.
Hi, John.
So, for people who aren't familiar with his work, how would you describe not just the kind of art, but the variety of art that John Baldessari was best known for?
John, of course, is one of the quote-unquote founders of the conceptual art movement, which sounds very grand. And John was not a grand person at all. He was a very funny guy, a very philosophical guy. The conceptualism based in his work basically came out of a desire to question the idea of what a work of art is. And he made objects of all kinds, from prints to collaged photographs to paintings on canvas to photographs on canvas. And John was curious to know how art fit within a mass media culture. And so that's what he began to explore.
I'm going to play a clip from an interview that you did with Baldessari in 2011 at the Hammer Museum. And it's this conversation about what is and is not art and who gets to decide when it becomes art.
If you have, let's say, a hunk of concrete with rebar in it, and you see it's out in the street, it's just a hunk of concrete with rebar in it. Put it in a museum, it's art, it's sculpture. So it's contextual. But if you see a canvas out in the street, it's still art. I mean, the context really doesn't, I mean, the signals are there. What else is, you know, it's going to touch a burned canvas.
And that makes me think about what he was as a teacher. He taught famously at CalArts and at UCLA. What was his legacy as a teacher in terms of how he changed perceptions of what was and was not art?
He always understood that as a teacher, it was not possible for him to instruct someone how to be an artist. But he also understood that what he could do would be to create the conditions within which a student could discover him or herself as being an artist. One of his most famous works is a text piece in which he scrawled on the wall in chalk, "I will not make any more boring art." And he scrawled it over and over and over, repeated it over and over and over. It's the kind of thing that a naughty student in elementary school is made to do. So the pedagogical aspect of that work is important, and the pedagogical interest of his own art in terms of creating an environment in which one can see oneself emerge is important.
We're talking with LA Times art critic Christopher Knight about the life and work of John Baldessari. I want to ask you about a piece that Baldessari did in the late 60s. It was called Tips for Artists Who Want to Sell. It was a sign, and it had three bullet points. I'll just read the first. Generally speaking, paintings with light colors sell more quickly than paintings with dark colors. And it goes on to describe what should be in those paintings. How did Baldessari see art and the art market? Was he comfortable with the fact that his art was worth something?
What he wanted more than anything was for people to look at his work. But there's one story I want to tell you from 2015, which I think explains a good deal about John, his work, his place within his work. In 2015, he made a multiple sculpture that had its debut in a party at the architect Kulapat Yantrasas. And when you arrived at the house for the presentation of the sculpture, there, hanging over the swimming pool, was an enormous sculpture of a carrot, an orange carrot with a green top. And I looked at the carrot, and I looked at John, and I thought, this carrot is a self-portrait. The carrot was about 6.5, 7 feet tall. John was 6'7". You always knew when John was in the room because he towered above everyone else. And the carrot kind of embodied what John's art interest was, and that is he saw a work of art as a carrot, not a stick, that whatever influence it had was not to beat you over the head, it was to entice you.
And just a couple years ago, John Baldessari went on The Simpsons as a voice actor and performed as himself.
So you've moved into painting giant schnozzes.
Marge, the mouth has had its say. Now it's time to find out what the nose knows.
That's a pull quote if ever I heard one.
Did Baldessari take himself not terribly seriously?
He took himself really seriously by not taking himself seriously. Humor is everywhere in John's work. But I think he understood that one of the great things about a joke is that the response to the joke is instantaneous. You either laugh or you don't laugh. And once you laugh, then you can begin to peel the artichoke and find out what is it that made you laugh? Why is this funny? But the humor is really important in his work.
Christopher Knight is the art critic at the Los Angeles Times. Christopher, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Happy to do it.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, Zahra Noorbakhsh. She's an Iranian-American comedian who challenges stereotypes with her stand-up and feels compelled to speak during difficult times like these. Stay with us. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. To say that this past week was tense in terms of foreign policy would be an understatement.
With around a half dozen explosions, the Americans firing with drones clearly didn't want to miss their target. Iran's general, Qasem Soleimani.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been hostile to our nation for decades.
They say they have shot ballistic missiles at multiple U.S. military facilities in Iran.
Iran is now breaking free of all restrictions on its nuclear program. We are not safer today.
So what is it like to be an Iranian-American during these tense times? Zahra Noorbakhsh is a comedian, and her bicultural identity is a key part of her stand-up.
My name is Zahra. I am a feminist, Muslim, Iranian-American comedian. Thank you! It doesn't always go that way.
But when Zahra arrived at KPCC the other afternoon, she hadn't yet heard the news that Iran had just fired missiles at American targets in Iraq.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't check the news today. And I actually haven't been looking at the news because when the first mention of war with Iran came up, I couldn't handle the clickbait flare of headlines about my family and their lives. So I just had to turn it off and wait for news from family members.
Tell me a little bit about your family coming to the States during the revolution, where you grew up.
I was born in Sacramento. So my birth certificate is public record. Go look it up. My nuclear family lives here. When the Iranian Revolution broke out, we couldn't go back. And we're left in a position much like we are in right now, wondering what's to come. When can we go back? When will things chill out? When can we see my grandma, aunts, uncles, cousins? And here we are again. I only went to Iran when I was 14. And there was this like window of time where things looked like maybe they're working out. There was a feminist inclined leader and things looked like maybe it's changing. And I got to meet my aunts and uncles and cousins and grandma for the first time. And I didn't want to leave. You know, it was my first experience of just unconditional love as a teenager in a Nirvana era. And we came back home and my dad came into my room and he said, we're staying, watch VH1 and catch up. Because up until that point, I was raised as though we were going to go back because my parents didn't want me to experience a culture shock if we went back. And when my parents decided that we were for sure staying, I wasn't at home in any culture. And VH1 did help a lot.
We're talking with comedian Zahra Nourbash. I want to play a little bit from a stand-up piece that you've done.
I say I'm Iranian. People get scared by this. I like to have fun with it. I like to sit in the front row of nuclear physics classes. Excuse me, professor. This plutonium. Can you find that on like the Craigslist?
I want to ask you not so much about that joke, but about your own identity and how it became part of your comedy. Was it always thus?
You know, it's funny when you played that joke because about 2 weeks ago, a friend of mine was like, isn't this kind of getting a little old? And here we are with a whole new sense of stakes. Identity. So very soon in my career as a stand-up comedian, I realized that if I don't say who I am and what I believe in at the top of my set, everyone will wonder the whole time I'm talking about farts and dicks and poop jokes. And so whether I wanted to or not, I had to understand my political identity.
You have a great title, Senior Fellow on Comedy for Social Change with the Pop Culture Collaborative. What is that? And how are you finding allies in what it is you're trying to do?
I find allies with people who have intersecting experiences with me. I am a self-identified bisexual, Iranian, feminist, Muslim woman in a relationship with a cisgendered, hetero, barista turned medical student, whitey white boyfriend man. And I've never really fit in any one community or place or box. And I'm always finding community in my lived experiences and by showcasing my lived experiences in my shows and performances and jokes. The Pop Culture Collaborative was this great opportunity for me to really look at my life in comedy and how I came to formulate my material the way that I have, and, you know, like why I have my identity up at the top and where our notions of humor come from and what is the weight of education that we put on people of color or people who we perceive as different than ourselves on stage to educate us that slows down our jokes. And what a lot of people do is rely on stereotypes. And I think those distillations, you know, the oversimplifying narratives that stereotypes are, is one way that I create difference, is complicating the narrative as much as I can.
But that's really tricky, because once you start to identify and kind of poke fun at the stereotype, you can actually solidify it.
I mean, I think no matter what I found is when it comes to confirmation bias, people are going to walk away believing whatever they want. But amazingly, I found that it's quantity over quality. And the best example of this is Fox News. It's not about how good the argument is. It's about how often you hear it. I think the best thing we can do right now is flood the world with gorgeous stories, complicated stories, messy stories that defy expectation and all the neat and tidy ways we want to create good guys and bad guys. And the more we do it, the more often we can do it, and the less we focus on how perfect it is, I think that's really, you know, where it's at.
So given what's going on, do you want to go out and grab a microphone, or do you want to go hide somewhere?
Oh, I'm grabbing a couple microphones. I'm headed up to San Francisco for Sketchfest. You can catch me there this weekend. I'm giving a TED Talk on comedy in Sonoma, and I'll also be performing at Ashkenaz in Berkeley. It's what I do. I got to get up on stage and share it.
Zahra Nourbash, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Zahra Nourbash is also the host of a podcast called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. There's an exhibit up now at LA's Natural History Museum. It's called Natural History of Horror, and it's all about scary movies. The Frame contributor Colin Friesen checked it out.
The Natural History of Horror exhibit isn't the largest display at the Natural History Museum, but on this rainy weekday, it's drawn a crowd. Standing by a man-sized costume for the creature from the Black Lagoon, Chris, a self-described longtime horror fan, says the attraction to spooky stuff is simple.
The creatures and the stories, definitely. Like, just the fantasy aspect of it.
And he's right, of course. It's a fantasy. There is no actual creature from the Black Lagoon, or an actual Dracula, or, well, there was a mummy, but not the mummy. You get it. But what this exhibit tries to show people is that behind the fantasy, you can find the unique scientific underpinnings that inspired some classic Hollywood horror.
The creature suit is on loan. The original doesn't survive, unfortunately. And then this mask is a pull from the original cast, but that doesn't survive either.
That's senior exhibition developer Sarah Crawford, who put this show together.
So the story we're talking about in this section is about a coelacanth, if you've ever heard of the coelacanth.
I hadn't, but it turns out a coelacanth is a big, ugly fish with gills and a lung that was considered the missing link in our evolutionary move from the water to the land. It was discovered a few years before they made the creature from the Black Lagoon, and its existence kind of makes the possible existence of the creature logical.
What was it? Science didn't know, but dedicated scientists were willing to risk their lives to find out.
This lungfish, the bridge between fish and the land animal. This one was a failure. It hasn't changed in millions of years. But here we have a clue to an answer.
Move a little further inside, and you'll get an explanation about how, without rabies, we might not have been gifted with Dracula.
Some scientists think that the vampire legend was inspired by rabies. If you look at the symptoms of both, they're kind of similar. When you are infected with rabies, you get over-sexualized, you get hydrophobic, you get averse to strong smells, you snarl, and then also two of the major rabies carriers, bats and wolves, are the very creatures that Dracula can shift into.
Now, people have always taken things that scare them, that they don't understand, and come up with fantastic and magical explanations. And what this exhibit does so well is reverse that, to show the natural or scientific discovery that got us these horror stories in the first place. Take our old pal Frankenstein, who might never have existed without an Italian doctor-slash-inventor-slash-philosopher who had some kind of weird hobbies.
Luigi Galvani, who was a scientist in the late 1700s, he basically was trying to figure out what made animals move. And so he took some severed frog legs, put them outside, attached a metal wire to them, and waited till they got struck by lightning. This caused the frog legs to move. So he thought, okay, I've discovered the secret to life. You might recognize that scene from Frankenstein, right? So Mary Shelley was very inspired by science and contemporary science, and she followed the work of Luigi Galvani and mentions him in her introduction to the book.
It's alive. It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. Oh, in the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
To illustrate this point, they'll let you zap real electricity through a fake frog's leg to simulate that great moment in scientific, if not frog, history. And over at the Dracula section, you can even play with some of the old-school Foley devices used to make sound effects for the movie, like coconuts for horse hooves and a sheet of metal for thunder. And finally, there's the movie The Mummy.
King Tut's tomb opening was an incredible media sensation. And actually, the Times of London was given exclusive rights to cover the tomb being opened, and so all these other media outlets started inventing stories about what was happening because they had nothing else to cover. And so that's how you get this idea of the curse, which became very popular and then, of course, inspired the movie The Mummy.
Crawford says in addition to being an entertaining look back at some little-known cinematic cause and effect, they'd like their exhibit to get people to think more critically about the things they encounter every day.
You know, science can appear to be boring or old and, you know, kind of fusty to people. And so to connect it to something in popular culture, you know, helps us and helps visitors maybe think about things they encounter in their daily life a little bit differently.
Is that the goal, to give someone their serving of vegetables but disguise it as really fun entertainment?
No, I hope that they start seeing the vegetables as tasty. That's kind of my hope.
Fine, tasty with a side of scary then. The Natural History of Horror exhibit runs until April 19th. For The Frame, I'm Colin Friesen.
It's the time of year on The Frame Weekend where we track what's happening in Hollywood's almost endless award season. This week, three of the industry's top guilds announced their nominations, and on Monday, we'll learn who's up for an Academy Award. Every guild, the writers, the producers, the directors, has nominated the World War I drama 1917. Directed by Sam Mendes, the film is co-written by him and Christy Wilson Cairns. When Mendes called up Cairns to pitch the idea for his film, she was all in.
He had this one image in his mind, and it was based on his grandfather. It was this 17-year-old boy carrying a message through no man's land lost in the fog.
Your orders are to get to the second at Quassia Wood, 1 mile southeast of the town of Lacoste. Deliver this to Colonel Mackenzie. It is a direct order to call off tomorrow morning's attack. If you don't, it will be a massacre. We will lose two battalions, 1,600 men, your brother among them. You think you can get there in time?
Yes, sir.
And then the last thing he said in that call was, oh, by the way, it's all going to be one shot. And he hung up after he dropped that bomb on me because he likes to, you know, do things in person. So the questions were saved for our first sit-down meeting.
I guess I have read that right after you got off the phone, you Googled one-shot films.
I did, yeah.
Which probably doesn't get you very far because they're not many.
No, there's not very many. And I was looking for their scripts because, you know, scripts are templates, you know. So I was looking for the formula that one-shot movies would take, like how it would look on the page. So I had to just be like, okay, right, there's nowhere to steal from. Like, you're going to have to make up as you go along.
When you have the device of a single take or what looks to be a single take, it changes the perspective of the audience. The audience, in some ways, is discovering things as the characters because the camera is never in front of the characters. What does that mean in terms of storytelling, in terms of the reality that you are creating for the characters and the audience, and how far or how far you can't push that reality?
Well, it's very difficult to put it very simply. It's super hard. And like you say, so when you're working in reality, everyone who's sitting in that cinema understands reality. That one shot is how we actually all live our lives. We live it in one continuous, unbroken take. Editing is sort of an artifice in film. And so what we were trying to do was strip all of that away.
We need to keep moving. Come on. I can't see.
As a writer, Sam and I had to sit down and sort of be like, well, how far can we push this? How much before it's too much? How kind of like dark and twisted and desperate can you make the audience before they start to look away? Because as soon as anyone looks away, you've lost them.
Meaning the audience might look away if it's too graphic, if it's too violent?
If it's too graphic, if it's too violent, if it's just too much. You know, the way I was, when I was writing this, I had a sort of, in my mind, I had a little kind of like ECG monitor of the audience's heart rate, and I was like, okay, now we've pushed up so far for so long, people are going to start to fatigue with action, so now you have to drop it back down and make it back into a character play.
Did you hear that story about Wilco? How he lost his ear?
Not in the mood. Keep your eyes on the trees, top of the ridge.
Bet he told you it was shrapnel.
What was it then?
Well, you know his girl's a hairdresser, right?
You have to, as a writer, kind of usually your sole focus is creating a good story that's a blueprint, especially as a screenwriter, that's a blueprint to make an excellent film. That's your job. And with this, there was all these extra burdens, extra caveats. So you were like, okay, because there's not going to be a traditional edit. There's not that final rewrite in the sense. You had to then do it in the script.
We're talking with Christy Wilson Cairns, the co-screenwriter of the movie 1917. So you have kind of the mathematical challenge of how this movie is going to be shot by Roger Deakins, but you have a narrative problem too, and that is, how is the story going to play out emotionally? And how do you try to figure that out as you're writing? Because if the audience doesn't care about these characters, no matter what the technology or the shots look like, they're not going to be in the story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can have the best kind of like cinematography in the world. And I'm slightly biased. I think we do. But if you don't have one or two characters who you root for, then what's the point? And I think that's the case with everything. You know, if you don't have someone in it that you love, someone in it that you feel represents you or your brother or your father or your son, then, you know, what's the point? You know, go and watch a documentary if you just want to learn about the war, or if you just want to see staggering film techniques, you know, watch music videos because they're usually the cutting edge for that. But for us, I mean, the whole point of this story from the very beginning was to make a film that felt like 110 minutes in someone else's life, that felt transportative and immersive. And you could only do that with two characters that you love and you hope they survive.
Christy Wilson-Cairns is the co-screenwriter of 1917. Christy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
1917 is in theaters now. Coming up on The Frame Weekend, Cristela Alonso went from learning English by watching TV to creating and starring in her own sitcom, which didn't exactly go as planned. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. When Cristela Alonso became the first Latina to create and star in a broadcast TV sitcom in 2014, it was a landmark event. But Cristela, as the show was called, was canceled after just a year. She writes about that in her book, Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. Late last year, after going on a comedy tour called My Affordable Care Act, Alonso taped this conversation with me at KPCC, where she also performed some stand-up.
My first language is Spanish. My mom never learned to speak English, so I had to learn English by watching TV shows like The Price is Right. And white people, you messed with me. Plinko's not a real word. I had no idea. I used to love that word. I used to say it all the time. I feel Plinko today, but it's not real. So I had to like watch TV and I would imitate what I heard on TV. So in my family, I'm the only one that doesn't have a super thick Mexican accent. My oldest brother, he was born in Mexico and he's got like a stereotypical accent. This guy sounds like a taco. You know what I mean? He's just like, hey, sister, you wanna go get something to eat? And I'm like, well, we could do that. Or would you like to see what's behind door number three? Come on down, you know?
When you were watching TV, listening to music, and then when you go off to high school, was there a time when you started realizing that what you could share as a performer made people laugh?
I actually found out that I could entertain people with my mom. My mom was an undocumented woman from Mexico who spent, I would say, about 20 years of her life trying to get her resident alien card. And I always say the name of it because I want people to know what it's called, the resident alien card. Coming from a background like that, if you're not familiar with it, you really don't understand what it entails to be undocumented here. My mom never got to see her family again. And I would see my mom very sad at times. And as a kid, I never wanted her to be sad. So I started making her laugh whenever I saw her face. And it was this connection that I had that started with my mom that actually allowed me to always try to find the person that looked the saddest or that had the roughest time and try to entertain them, because that was all I could afford to give, which was myself. And I think that's kind of how I still treat comedy.
I'm going to ask you about your show, Cristela. When you look back in writing the book about that experience, do you remember it differently now that you have perspective?
Now that I look back on it, I look back on it in a different experience, because it's been so many years that you also gather new information and time evolves, and then you realize that what was really never was the way that it was presented to you. I don't regret anything, any feelings, any thoughts, any decisions, nothing that I made. But I do look back and realize that people that loved the show, I think, really loved the story of the show. having known what happened and having time passed, I realized that when people ask me if I will ever bring the show back, I always say it would be absolutely impossible because that would mean working with people that tried to ruin my dream from the get-go.
Do you think the world has changed in any way? Do you think that there is a openness to understanding and representing different cultures, different stories?
It hasn't changed. Representation still sucks. It'll always suck if we still have the same gatekeepers, same tastemakers in powers of position. I did a panel at the Ford Foundation in 2015 where the show had just been canceled, and I was doing a panel about diversity, of course, and I was doing it with my friend Jeff Yang, who's a kid, Hudson, is on Fresh Off the Boat. And we're talking about our experiences, you know, with the network, blah, blah, blah. And he goes first because his show is still on the air. And he talks about how lovely everybody is and blah, blah, blah. And then after he was done, I'm like, I had the opposite experience to you. And then I realized when he spoke that it was because that year, the head of casting for ABC and the head of comedy development were both Asian women. So they understood what the show was trying to do. It was personal. And that's what we need. We need the personal ties. There was no Latino in charge of anything when I had my show. And when people talk about, like, you know, oh, but we have these opportunities and more diversity, more representation, again, it's what I call agenda porn. It's these issues that we come up with that are now a hot topic, which we gather from the media. So it's like, what is the media showing? Deportations, immigration. So those are the stories we tend to see. I always say the things that really, really kill an opportunity for a Latino show to exist, we have to stop using two words. That's multi-generational and aspirational. Multi-generational always implies that you're going to teach someone a lesson. We don't do that with white shows. And also the idea of aspirational, I used to get that note a lot. I learned that by aspirational, they meant successful. They wanted to show stories of successful people. Well, my whole thing is aspiration is you have to see the ascension of a journey. You have to see that regular person thriving and trying to succeed because then you know that you have hope.
We're talking with Christelle Alonzo about her book, Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up.
You guys, I'm 40 years old. I just got health insurance like 2 years ago, man. It is a game changer. Like, people in my neighborhood wear Chanel. I wear like empty prescription bottles, like right here. Like, I'm like, that's right, bitch. Antibiotics. Boom. Try that. You know how rich people like to tell you they're rich? They're like, we just got back from Paris. I'm like, I just got back from LensCrafters. I know, look at this, I know. After the election, I stopped doing stand-up. I kind of quit because I felt really guilty trying to make money off of my community because I knew that the people that came and saw me they were gonna need the money. I felt guilty. I felt guilty trying to make a living because the people that went to see me, that support me, they're like my family, like how I grew up. And I just felt so selfish. And I stopped doing stand-up and I started going around and helping people. And for the next couple of years, I started going around and just visiting communities and really trying to help grassroots from anything that I could do. And I love stand-up. I love stand-up. And I love it so much. But when the 2016 election happened, for me, there was something bigger. And now, with my stand-up, I use it to talk about my experiences. I don't talk about the person directly because you might not agree with my truth, but you can't deny that it's my truth.
Cristela Alonso is a writer and a comedian. Her new book is Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. It's out now. Cristela, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everybody coming out. Thank you.
To close out the Frame Weekend, we've got a story about the label Daptone Records. It's home of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, Charles Bradley, and the band Antibolus. The Brooklyn-based indie label was co-founded by Gabriel Roth, a musician, producer, and engineer who is now based in California. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos visited Roth's recording studio and has this profile of the man behind the Daptone sound.
It's a Wednesday afternoon at the Penrose Studios, located on the second floor of a building in downtown Riverside. Producer Gabriel Roth is at the helm, playing organ as the San Diego-based group The Sacred Souls rehearses a song they're about to record today. Most of the Daptone Records operations is in Brooklyn, but about a decade ago, Roth moved here to set up shop, and in the past year, he noticed a re-emerging music scene in Southern California.
I started to meet more and more musicians out here and kind of discover this kind of local scene, this kind of resurgence of this. Well, it's hard to say resurgence because the scene has always been here in California, this kind of soulies scene, you know, which is, you know, mostly Chicano scene, but just a lot of people out here that have always been into oldies and old soul records.
Roth was born in the San Bernardino area and grew up in Riverside.
And when I was 17, I moved to New York, and I was there for most of my adult life.
In 2001, Roth and saxophonist Neil Sugarman launched Daptone Records and ushered in a revival of soul music. Since then, the label has released more than 50 albums and 130 45s of soul, R&B, funk, gospel, rock, Afrobeat, and Latin music. One of Daptone's biggest artists is soul singer Sharon Jones. Roth produced and wrote most of the songs for her group, the Dap Kings. He recorded hundreds of songs with Jones, including Fish in the Dish, from the album Naturally.
Fish in the Dish is a song I wrote for Sharon, and she just dug her teeth into it, man. It's a beautiful, just to hearing the joy when she sings that song.
But Jones died about 3 years ago from pancreatic cancer.
Playing behind Sharon was probably the, you know, it's a thrill in my life, and it was probably, in a lot of ways, you know, always be the high point of my musical career. You know, with her passing, there's definitely a little bit disorienting trying to find my footing, you know, because, I mean, it's not as much as like, oh, I got to try to figure out how to make money or hustle or find another singer or some like that. It has nothing to do with that. It's more about just kind of taking a real step back and being like, well, what do I really have to contribute at this point? You know what I mean? I'm not trying to do what I did again.
Another artist whose career was launched by Daptone Records was soul singer Charles Bradley. Sadly, he died about a year after Sharon Jones.
Charles Bradley has a lot of great songs, man. In You, I Found a Love, that's a Hello, great baby. One, man. The World was obviously a big one. The Telephone Song is one of my favorites.
To hear your voice, you know, you're way across the ocean, now way over here.
And my love, Jones. Bradley and Jones put the Brooklyn-based label on the map. But somewhere along the way, Roth started to feel a tug.
In 2010, I believe, my wife and I, you know, we had our daughter Penelope and stuff, and we wanted to live a mellower life, so we moved back out here, moved back to Riverside.
Roth found an old building downtown Riverside and rented part of the second floor. There are no computers in the studio. All the music is recorded on analog tape.
It's a process that takes a little bit longer. It's a little bit more time-consuming, working with tape, working with all the musicians at the same time.
29-year-old Simon Guzman has been working as an engineer with Daptone Records for the past 7 years.
At the end of the day, when the record comes out, it sounds, that's the sound. It sounds like it was recorded by a bunch of people in the same room, and we're all throwing ideas. So it's if Daptone has a sound, that's the sound.
Looking back at the success of his work with all these artists, Roth, now 45, says he's in a different phase of his life and career. he has the resources to contribute to the R&B scene in Southern California.
I'm in a great position to help these younger artists who actually have their own scene that isn't my scene. It's not something I create. It's not something that I take credit for. It's not something I, you know, lay claim to or put my flag in necessarily, but it's something that I feel like, I kind of was where they were 20-something years ago, you know, me and my friends and kind of a scene and getting, oh, you sing backgrounds on my record and I'll play bass on your record and, you know, these kind of bands that are working together and starting to appreciate similar music.
Adriana Flores is a singer in two East LA groups, The Altones and The Sincere's. Both groups have been recording at the Dapton Studios in Riverside.
First of all, it's a dream. Like, if anyone ever asked me what label or anything I would want to do with, it would be Dapton, anything associated, because I'm a huge fan of all their acts.
And next spring, the music of both R&B groups will be released on a new Dapton imprint called Penrose. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that is it for The Frame Weekend. The show is edited and produced by Darby Maloney, along with Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Emily Henderson. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday for The Frame Daily.